From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The 2020 presidential election is bringing back memories of election night 2016, when the nation was preparing to usher in the first female president and instead got Donald Trump. Nearly 4 years of relentless repression, lies, constitutional insults, ethical violations, human rights abuses, and white supremacist resurgence has left us weary and wary. Polls show Democratic nominee Joe Biden with a healthy lead, but polls were misleading 4 years ago. Biden is not Trump, but neither is he Bernie Sanders. He is a continuation of neoliberal centrist Democratic Party policies. But the alternative is something that even many Republican Party members are now fearful of. Joining me to discuss what's at stake this November is Michael Denzel Smith, author of the New York Times bestseller Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Harper's, The Nation, The Atlantic, and more. He's a fellow at Type Media Center. And his latest book is called Stakes is High, Life After the American Dream. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
It's been many years since we had you on our program, and so much has happened. What is remarkable about these past 4 years is that some of us have survived, but not all of us. There's been so much repression, as I mentioned, and people are really weary. Is that the reason why you wrote this book, to try to understand and make sense of what brought Trump into power and what, you know, what we can expect in the next few months?
Well, the part of the reason for writing the book is that I understood exactly what brought Trump to power, but I was in denial at that time, like I think so many of us were. And so on election night, it was just realizing we're seeing American history play out as it always does. For all of the limitations of the Obama administration, and I'll be the first one to critique everything about that administration and Barack Obama as a public figure, a politician, a public intellectual, it did represent for some people a sense of progress, right? Like there's something that happened that shifted in the country to allow the country to have 8 years of its first Black president. And for another part of the country, what that meant was, and these are particularly aggrieved white men, that the country was slipping away from them. They were no longer the center of American identity. And so they were fighting back, and they fought back in the form of Donald Trump. And everyone invested in everything that Donald Trump represents got on board with that. And so it's not so much that I needed to make sense of why it happened. I understood why it happened. I needed to make sense of why I, even as a critic of US empire, a critic of US capitalism, a critic of US racism, still fell into the trap of believing that this country could be on some linear sense of progress. Why did I feel that way? And really it's to say that no matter where we sit, those of us who are a part of this country have bought in to some degree to the American narrative. And the American narrative just states that we are always progressing, that we are a beacon of democracy, and that we are the greatest nation on the face of the earth. And so even as a critic, even as someone who doesn't feel like they buy into all of those things and the things that fall under those types of ideas, I've bought into some degree, and I wanted to understand why that was, and then to challenge other people to see where they have been buying into that narrative so that we can divest from it, because that's the only way that we're going to break ourselves free of a cycle that produces Donald Trump's.
So do you think that this notion that America is the greatest democracy on the planet has, you know, sort of created a sense of hubris collectively that in part made us vulnerable to what happened nearly 4 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the American identity is built on hubris. It's built on this, the idea that we're better than anything that has ever existed, anything that ever will exist, and that we must protect the borders of America, and I say that both physically and metaphorically, the borders of America and American identity, and that, you know, anything that's a threat to it must be eradicated. And so we buy into this, all of us, and I say that I place myself in that and make myself culpable, because I did, and as I write in the book, sort of like looked at New York City as this place that could foster all of the hopes and dreams that I had for myself. But New York City is the place where that created Donald Trump, like as a microcosm, right? Like New York City is the place where Trump's family was able to prosper in the ways that they did, by exploiting people, by being slumlords. And that Donald Trump was able to create his ology through New York media. It's the place that I live, and that I can go outside and I can see more police officers than trash cans on my block. It's to say that, you know, for everything that we tried to hold dear about what America represents in our imagination, none of it holds up to have the actual to reality. None of it does. And so we get this sense, because of the way of American history has been told, the way that American identity has been constructed, that we simply have to claim American, and therefore we are better. And that hubris means that we don't listen to critique. We don't listen to the ways in which people are trying to push America, the US, to be better. We don't acknowledge those things in any real way, unless they're couched in very soft language that reinforces the very idea of American exceptionalism. And then when those critiques are presented that way, people don't hear the critique. All they hear is the stuff about loving America.
Then this year, we've had, sort of broadly speaking, three huge dents in American hubris: the coronavirus pandemic and the way in which it's played out, where literally people outside the country feel sorry for us, massive racial injustice coming to a head, you know, the documentation being in our face, even though, of course, it has a very long history, and police repression and brutality, so embarrassing saying that the United Nations is calling for the country to deal with it, climate catastrophe on both coasts. These are huge reality checks for Americans, right?
They should be. They absolutely should be. I don't know how many, like, that's the thing that I see these images of people marching so that they don't have to wear a mask. And I think to myself, you know, how is it that people are so invested in the idea of the individual to the point that they're not willing to put a piece of cloth over their face to protect their neighbor? You know, like the idea that they just don't believe that COVID exists, or that it's overblown.
And in fact, and that, just to interrupt you for a second, Attorney General William Barr recently said that he thought COVID restrictions were the worst impact on civil liberties and civil rights since slavery.
Yes, yes. I mean, the idea that you can't go to a bar is the same as slavery, or similar, or just as could rise to that sort of level of degradation. I mean, it's ridiculous, but it's also the way in which we've constructed simply the idea that America can overcome everything. And so, you know, the fires are raging out there on the West Coast and making the air unbreathable. And this is going to continue happening. And there are people who are trying to act as if the fires themselves are a conspiracy, that this is somehow an agenda that's being put forth by people to take away their liberties. And I think people get hung up on the idea of what liberty and what freedom means. And it's always like this freedom to, the freedom to consume more, the freedom to live exactly the way that they have decided needs to be, is proper, and that doesn't pay attention to anyone else's needs or acknowledge anyone else's presence, that defines an other that needs to be eradicated, another that needs to be subjected to forms of violence that would be reprehensible if they were experienced by these people. It's just to say, you know, these should be wake-up calls, especially the stuff with regards to climate disaster, because we have so little time to address it. But somehow the American hubris persists, and we don't have much time. Like the title of the book is "Stakes Is High," because they're the highest that they've been. If we don't act now, we're talking about the very extinction of our species.
You dedicate your book, one of the people you dedicate your book to is Shirley Chisholm. And there was, of course, an era in America that elders remember that seemed very similarly existential when people were just fighting for the right to vote, fighting for the right to be treated equally, to be able to, you know, use a lunch counter the same as anybody else. Is there anything we can learn from that time that can apply now to this new reality? I mean, it's similar, but it's also very different.
It's very different. And I think, you know, in exploring the legacy of Shirley Chisholm, what I was trying to get us to confront is that, you know, through the course of American history and the telling of American history, there arise these figures that are real critics of American exceptionalism, real critics of the American identity, the things that make it up, but yet somehow they get subsumed into the fabric of that story as if their bravery is somehow uniquely American, but the obstacles they face were not. And so the question to be asking about Shirley Chisholm and her legacy is not to be celebrating that she was the first Black woman elected to Congress or the first Black woman to run for president on a major party ticket. The question is, why did it take so long for a Black woman to be able to do that? And why was she unable in 1972 to garner even 2% of the Democratic Party vote? What did she stand for that they're so afraid of? And you look at her actual record and you look at what she was fighting for as a member of Congress, and you say, now we can celebrate her or bring her up in a conversation with Barack Obama, Shirley Chisholm paving the way for Barack Obama to be able to run, paving the way for Hillary Clinton to be able to run, when their records don't match up. It's like the very first speech that Shirley Chisholm delivered on the House floor was an anti-Vietnam War speech that called into question America's commitment to using its resources to kill and maim us overseas while people starved here at home. These are things that are the actual part of her legacy. And so I think what I want us to take away from this is that the legacies of these people that we continually invoke as some sort of, as part of the story of what makes America great, have often been people that have fiercely criticize the very nature of the American system, of our structures. And we can't continue to allow these people to be used in such a way that reinforces that story as opposed to questions it.
And yet we are told, especially in the last few years, that any criticism of American, what has happened to America is an affront, an insult to the flag, is a slap in the face of democracy and patriotism. And, you know, if you kneel down to protest racist violence by police, you're somehow insulting veterans. This is a very convenient way in which Trump and his backers seem to be able to silence their critics, and unfortunately, too many in the mainstream accept too much of it.
Yeah, and you bring up the NFL protest and where it started in the NFL, and Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the national anthem and people's criticisms that he was disrespecting the flag, disrespecting the anthem, disrespecting the veterans, disrespecting our armed forces. The idea that those two things are synonymous, essentially, that the only way to fight for American freedom is through a military aggression, speaks to just what we value, right? What we think of in terms of how that's constructed. American freedom, then if it is tied directly to American imperialism through military efforts and through military violence, means that what we're protecting ourselves from is the idea of outside invaders, anything that comes that's going to attack us, right? And so there's that construction. And then there's the idea that even if you look at American history and you say that you're going to celebrate the end of things like segregation, you're going to celebrate the end of slavery, you're going to celebrate people who fought for the right for women to vote and all of these things that like America loves to hold up as only possible in America or things that are uniquely American. If those people aren't then freedom fighters or people that represent the flag, people who represent the ideas that are supposed to be embodied in the flag, if it's only the military, then what are you actually saying about who matters here and what stories matter and who's protected by that flag? What people are saying when they try to invoke that is essentially that flag is supposed to hold all of us, all of these things, but there's things in there that are diametrically opposed to one another. The flag can't be draped over both the police and the people protesting the police and think that all of that can be American. If that's the case, then American means nothing. The flag stands for absolutely nothing. There are no values, no principles that are being upheld. All you're trying to do is just to uphold the status quo of violence being enacted on people to ensure that they are second-class citizens. And so when people are trying to suss out like what's disrespectful to American symbols, it's to say that they're so tied up with the symbol and what they think or what they have projected onto it, as opposed to dealing with the substance of it.
Let's talk about inequality and capitalism. The subtitle to your book is Life After the American Dream. And so much of what those words American Dream embodies is this idea that anybody can get ahead in America. Today, we have massive inequality during the pandemic that has increased even more. Literally, the rich have gotten rich off the pandemic. And yet we have a party in the country that supports capitalism and another party in the country that supports capitalism, if we just talk about the two major parties. How do we get beyond these beliefs and this fundamentalist almost faith in capitalism as the salvation of America when all evidence points to the contrary? Because, you know, poverty is a huge part of the problem, but poverty is also the reason why Trump was able to get elected, by showing that, you know, by claiming to be populist, because Democrats didn't do enough about poverty.
Yeah, I do believe that there has been during the course of our dealing with this pandemic potential for radicalizing people, and when I say that, I mean introducing them to the failures of capitalism, right? So in the beginning, what was happening? They debated it for a while, but the federal government did eventually send people a check for $1,200, and people are on unemployment were seeing an increase to $600 a week, right? There were so many people for whom that was much better than what they were making at their jobs, right? Like employed full time and yet making below that. And that figure for unemployment was calculated on the idea of minimum wage for 40 hours of work. So if people are making below that, and now they were for a time getting more than that from unemployment, then hopefully what someone is doing in on the ground organizing is pointing that out to folks and saying, well, that just means that you've been underpaid and undervalued for a long time, and that's the way that capitalism works. And I think also there have been potential for different ways of showing alternative models to say, you know, during this time, mutual aid networks have cropped up. And like, it's to say that you're not reliant on a benevolent billionaire. It's your neighbors. It's a community that holds itself up, that supports one another. And also, as you point out, that people have been getting richer. People who are billionaires already are becoming mega billionaires precisely because of a pandemic. And if you can see that and you can see all of these things clearly and someone puts those things together for you, I think that there is the potential for a radicalization and people understanding the fault lines of capitalism if it's pointed out to them. The problem though is exactly what you allude to, is that the American dream is built on the idea that you can go from nothing to something. That by dint of your own ability, by dint of your own merit, your own intelligence and your own hard work, you can go from having nothing in this world to being one of those people that have everything, being one of the rich people, being one of the 1% of 1% of 1%. Well, it's not only that is it immoral to want to be in part of a 1% of a 1% that has everything while people have nothing. It's immoral to think that there are people that should have nothing, that they should be in a position in which they have to fight and claw and strive just to make it to a point where they have a decent life. What does that say about how we value life? And I think we have to start thinking of capitalism in a moral context and present it to people in that way, that capitalism is a failure of morality.
Finally, Michael, your book is written as a personal essay from a first-person narrative perspective, and I'm wondering if you think it's important for us to start really talking about the ways in which our political experiences in this country impact us personally and really find ways to be honest with ourselves and society about what we are thinking and what we are feeling. It's a moment in this country's history where there's a tremendous amount of despair. Expectations have been shattered. And so is that what you're also doing with this book in terms of trying to lay yourself bare?
I'm trying to acknowledge and own my own culpability within the production of the American story and my buying into the delusions that have been set forth, and to examine my place in that, and to set that as a guide for others to be able to do that as well. And I think, you know, as sort of like as a literary device, you know, the personalizing of these things helps people to place themselves in your shoes, helps people to see that in a clearer way once you get down to the sort of granular level. Like I could do sort of a high-minded philosophy and political text, and there's like hopefully some of that is coming through, but if it's not relatable, if people aren't seeing themselves within that story, if people aren't with you on a journey, there are ways in which things can be missed. And I'm hoping to connect to an audience, because what we need is not simply just the individual stories. We need those individual stories to grow into a collective, because it's the collective action, it's the collective consciousness that's going to be responsible for any sort of change.
Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
My guest is Michael Denzel Smith, author of the New York Times bestseller Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Harper's, The Nation, The Atlantic, and more. He's a fellow at Type Media Center, and we've been discussing his latest book. It's called Stakes is High, Life After the American Dream. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.